Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. How you doing this evening? Welcome, everybody.
Yes, welcome to the program. Tonight we have Paranexus board member and all around, should we call him a joker? Should we call him
humorist?
There we go. The team humorist, Dave Desjardins. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Doug. How you doing, Grant?
Good, Dave. It's good to have you back with us.
Thanks.
Yes, thanks.
Everybody in the chat room. The rest of the listeners.
Yes, and tonight we're going to be talking about conventional versus non-conventional approaches to anomalous research. And tonight's discussion is really there to provoke to thought and get people thinking. And some of the different things we've tossed around here and there. And this is a topic that Dave picked. So if anybody gets pissed, it's not our fault.
Oh, yeah. We'll never let you forget it, Dave. We'll never let you live it down.
That's right. So if you want to get in on the conversation, you can participate in a couple of ways. One is in the chat room. You can ask questions there. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, you can do that. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. Or if you have a headset on your computer, you can use that click-to-talk button there on your screen. So, Dave, conventional versus non-conventional, or conventional and non-conventional approaches, you had some different things that you had made a list of, some different things we talked about. Let's start with the conventional thinking. What are you thinking here? What's some of your list?
Okay, well, I think before I get on my soapbox here, I could probably to reiterate what Doug was getting at earlier. This topic is something that I take kind of personal. It's not intended in any way to upset anybody, but it is intended to challenge certain ways of thinking. There's a lot of very specific ways of thinking when it comes to paranormal investigation. And I like to take that every so often, throw it in a box, shake it up, and turn it on its head.
Yeah.
With that said, if you take a look at conventional thinking in today's anomalous research, you're looking at scenarios where, you know, a location has to be, any old location is haunted. Okay, well, you know, that doesn't really bode with me. You're looking at other theories that, you know, it has to be not only 100 years old, but it has to be the site of a tuberculosis clinic, or it has to be the site of some murder, some sort of tragedy, negative energy, you know, something where the energy has a reason to hang around. Okay, well, you know, when you think about it, what hard evidence do we have to suggest that? I mean, we have other researchers out there right now. Ingrid, who is listening in on the chat room, I noticed, she conducts her research within her head. And she's getting some phenomenal results with her EVP research. So, based on that, and I've been speaking to numerous other researchers around the world that they don't go out necessarily to the 100-year-old tragic locations. They'll conduct research within their own living rooms, within controlled environments, within, you know, areas that have absolutely zero history whatsoever, the middle of a farmer's field. And, you know, they're getting pretty much the same results that some of these organizations are getting from the 100-year-old tuberculosis clinics. So, you know.
Yes. So what you're saying is that the belief that some location must be old or had a catastrophe or tragedy is just, there's no proof for that.
There's no. From what I've seen and conversations that I've had with different researchers around the world and research that I've been conducting on my own, there's no hard-fast evidence to suggest that.
Yeah, but what about so many hauntings that where people have died in the house and so they have activity?
Sure, you get a lot with that. You've got a lot of cases of residual hauntings. There's not necessarily any more intelligent type hauntings than there is in, say, my living room.
Dave, that brings up a really good point, though, because, you know, all of us are familiar with what usually composes a residual haunting. But you know what? There may be some people out there that can't even think outside of the box. And they're going to automatically, you know, just assume that they're in a spot, like your whole premise here, assume that they're in a spot, and it's going to completely shade all of the research they do based on what they believe is there.
Exactly.
Yep. So that belief thing comes into play a lot.
Yep, very much.
Well, you know what? It may be true that haunted location doesn't have to be old, you know, but I'm telling you, I know that cemeteries are haunted.
They are. There's bugs and
orbs.
All kinds of critters, yeah, orbs, yeah, moisture, rain droplets, yeah, you name it.
Orbs, especially if they're located at the end of a dirt road, the orbs galore.
Oh, yeah.
Spirits like dirt roads better. What can I say?
They like living out in the country, Doug.
Yeah, it's funny you should bring that up, though, Doug. You know, what?
Oh, it wasn't by accident.
Oh, I know.
I got your list, too.
Looking at cemeteries, how many, show of hands, well, okay, I won't do the show of hands.
I got my hand raised, Dave.
Yeah, I know you do, Grant. How many people have hung out at a cemetery with tape recorders, cameras, trying to catch, you know, anything paranormal? Okay, my question to you is why? Think about it. If you go back to the previous series where some place has to contain trauma or whatnot, what's to suggest the cemetery is haunted? I mean, has anybody ever been killed in a cemetery? I mean, realistically, just because it contains a lot of dead people doesn't mean that it contains the spirits of dead people. If you want to look at morgues, how many people have ever heard of haunted morgues? No?
I'd say I've ever heard of any.
Or you like
I'd say more cemeteries. People would say more cemeteries are haunted, you know. The famous ghost story about the girl who's picked up along the side of the road and they drop her off, and where does she go? Into the cemetery, you know?
You know, when I pass on, I can think of hundreds of different places to hang out other than, you know, the local cemetery. But, again, you've got belief. I'm working a case right now. The location just happens to be across from the cemetery, and that's one of the first questions that I was asked. Do you think the cemetery has anything to do with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a social belief, something we were all raised with.
True. True. I mean, and, you know, as being
cross-cultural, for sure, no doubt about that. That That trans everything. It's supposed to be a sacred place.
Being in law enforcement, I mean, I will admit they are a phenomenal place to get caught up in your paperwork. Nobody bugs you.
And study. Spirits don't bug you?
Yeah, I haven't had any problems.
But you know, a lot of people do a lot of research in cemeteries, and it's not that they're, you know, I think a lot of times, maybe it's a great place to start, because my concern about cemeteries and why I'm so jaded, there's a number of reasons, but just the variables out in the cemetery, whether, you know, when you're taking digital photographs or at night or day, it's just like, wow, you know.
Any location is a nightmare.
Yeah. So you're going to get all kinds of stuff, and most folks, if you're doing it, unlike whether they're fortunate to live down south where the temperature never goes below 50 degrees down here in Florida. Ha ha. But, right. you know, all the critters come out in the summertime up there, up in the north, you know, probably 100 times worse than it is down here, because they only get one shot at it before it's ready to start snowing again. So everything's in the air up there. We've had people submit evidence here, Dave, that, you know, it looks like a B-52 flying through the air over our cemetery, and it's a big June bug or something.
And even when you look at EVPs, okay, you know, you're in the middle of a cemetery. Take a look around. Where are you? You're in a big open field surrounded by rather large marble slabs. Whether you see anybody or not, those slabs are going to bounce sound all over the place. So just because, you know, you don't see anybody, or, you know, you don't hear anybody, that doesn't mean that your super sensitive little recorder is not going to pick up somebody chatting, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, and just remember what we talked about in our previous show last week about how the one of the true measures, like Ingrid was talking about, was the fact that it's disarticulated human speech. It's speech that's broken up and has no characteristics that it came from a human. So, I mean, if you got all that going on in there, it's got to be very suspect. There's just too many variables.
Yeah, absolutely. I find anything that's outside is, you know, any evidence that you pick up is got to be questioned.
Well, you think about the cemetery. I mean, we've talked about EVPs. I mean, this has been a fairly recent discussion that we've had among ourselves, Ingrid and several of us, about EVPs and, you know, where they're coming from. Well, we really don't know where they come from. You know, a lot of people believe that they're, you know, the voices of dead people, of ghosts, whatnot. But we can't really say that necessarily. We really don't know the source. We can't prove the source. And if you... this point about the belief, you know, what role does belief and expectation and intention play on the part of the investigator at the scene? So if we're brought up with the social conditioning that cemeteries that contain dead bodies, therefore, you know, they might contain the ghosts of those people, and we go into a cemetery and we're, you know, we've got this preconceived notions and this belief, you know, to what degree does that belief, that intention, that expectation play in the number or the type of EVPs that we get?
Yeah, it certainly makes you wonder.
Mm-hmm. It does, and it seems to support that, because a lot of people have gotten a lot of EVPs in a cemetery, and a lot of people have had so-called experiences, you know, but it's nighttime, and you know about the peripheral vision. I mean, Dave, you well know that. You talked about that. Why don't you mention, you know, the problem with peripheral vision and what we see?
Doug, do you mean that ghosts out of the corner of your eyes aren't real?
Did I say that?
Dave, you're not going to shatter my belief in that. I
shatter
out of the corner of my eyes all the time, Dave. So don't bring my world crashing down. Don't change my reality.
Do it, Dave, do it. He likes it.
Oh, you're driving a stake through my heart, Dave.
Hell, you haven't even started yet.
I know.
Hammer.
One of your eyes, aren't you, Grant?
Yeah.
The thing with peripheral vision is, I mean, it all comes down to the way the rods and cones line up in your eyes. Why people shadows predominantly out the corners of their eyes is because your peripheral vision, past a certain degree, I forget what it is off the top of my head, I think it's 60 degrees forward and 130 peripheral or something like that. At that 130 degree, for the sake of argument, vision, you're only seeing black and white anyways, based on the way your rods and cones line up, which is why majority of the people will see shadows out of the corner of the rod. When they look full on, rods and cones line up a little better, and the color spectrum comes into play, your shadow disappears.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, the idea is that peripheral vision is intended to, I mean, it's a security thing, it's a protection, right?
Yeah.
We can see, we detect movement.
Yeah, that's basically what it's for, but we're stereoscopic. We don't see out of the side, so anything that you see out of the side of your eye is a distortion. Nothing more than a distortion. But how many times have all three of us been on an investigation and you go to interview somebody, you're interviewing prior or listening, talking to somebody on a telephone, and they start telling you that they see things out of the corners of their eyes.
Yeah,
absolutely. And when you ask them, the first thing that you ask, you know, I ask is, have you ever seen them full on? And 9 times out of 10?
Or more,
absolutely.
Yeah, so you look at the shadows, you look at the tombstones, and it doesn't have to be the cemetery for the peripheral vision thing effect to take come into play. You know, I do it at home. I mean, you know, we have cats here, and I'll think I'll see our white kitty, you know, sleeping, and I look twice and full on, and it's a blanket, it's something else. I mean, that happens. It happens to us all the time. We might think we see something, and we look, and no, it was something else. So that's another thing. And so we have all these experiences in cemeteries, you know, and is it real? I mean, I agree with you, Dave. Logic just doesn't dictate that these spirits would be hanging out. Now, who knows? I mean, do they zip here and there and everywhere? Or, you know, if you go into a cemetery and call them, what's the difference in doing that and just having a seance and calling them and they show up?
Yeah. But you know how are researchers thinking out of the box? Look, how many people have investigated cemeteries, and what kind of data can we really call valid that comes out of any kind of investigation? It's strictly, and I mean this without harming any of our brethren out there in the field, it's strictly for amateurs. When you're, I'm not saying we're high-flying professional, you know, super guys with lab coats on and that kind of stuff, but we are social scientists in the sense that we're here and we're doing an investigation, and we need to think out of the box when we're trying to capture something that may be very elusive, if it indeed exists. So, you know, I just see people doing that as wasting their time.
Or training purposes.
What contribution does it make to the field? What contribution? How does it make that person a better researcher other than, as you were about to say, Doug, training?
Yeah. I mean, we're past that, and that's the point of this whole program tonight, and that's coming up in Dave's list, that we're beyond, you know, that point now. I mean, we're at the crux, and I'm not going to get too far ahead. I'm just going to state that we're at the crux where things need to change, and we'll get into that.
Just touching back on the vision for a little bit, I recently read an article. I forget exactly where I read it. It was in one of the, I think it was in a medical journal, actually. But it was going on about human vision and how any given day, based on how the eyes and the brain works, we're blind for 40 minutes on any
day. Yeah.
Now, it's important to remember when a person sees something, it's not the eyes necessarily that are seeing it. The brain.
Mm-hmm.
Eyes of the camera, it's the brain that's interpreting it. Now, our eyes constantly darting around.
Wait, could you repeat that last part, Dave? You just kind of faded out a little bit.
Oh, sorry. Our eyes are constantly darting around. It's capturing multiple views from different angles. It's constantly refocusing, constantly adjusting itself, and it's constantly changing its the light levels are constantly changing. So all of this information and this data is being sent to the brain. It's all being processed so fast that it can't keep up necessarily with all the information, and the brain is filling in the blanks. The end result, to us, everything seems to be in focus, and we are seeing everything that is going on at all times, when, that's not necessarily the fact. The brain is filling in a lot of the blanks that are in there.
I think, too, a lot of times, Dave, I think, people don't have any idea about themselves that we're creatures of perception and how faulty our perception can be at times.
We're very visual creatures, myself, if I don't see something, I have a hard time comprehending it or learning it. I'm a very visual type person. But then again, I think all males are. If I read that correctly,
a lot of people are visual, regardless of gender. I found in my hypnosis work, I found that ladies tend to be better subjects. Not always, but because of the visualization and I enjoy that part. It makes my job easier.
Well, I think our feminine counterparts are more in touch with their sensitive side than a lot of us Neolithic guys are. A lot of times men are not in touch with their feelings. Women are, and women are encouraged to express their feelings more too, so it goes a long way to getting to the difference, no doubt about that.
So what's next on our list?
Well, next on the list is something that I like to call us.
Dave, you're fading out just a little bit. Could you try it once more?
Can you hear me now?
It just kind of fading a little bit. Well, I think what you said was us, me, and we.
Yes, I like to call it the us, me, and we theory. Right now, any given time, a number of individual organizations that are researching the anomalous, whether it be ufology, cryptozoology. Now, we've got all of these people out researching these different topics who, for whatever reason, will not or do not publish their findings. They don't want to share information. They don't want to reveal evidence, aside from maybe, posting on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
To me, YouTube's not a scientific means of, a means of scientific scrutiny, and I don't particularly consider anything posted on YouTube as being credible. Look at the stuff you can find on YouTube, and it's all labeled real UFOs, real ghosts. That's really the other thing. It's all crap, if you ask me. It's not credible. In order to have substantive results, as a community, we have to share our findings. How are we expected if we cannot share the findings and share our evidence with you?
Hey, Dave, hold on one sec. Hey, Grant, is your headset mic set on Skype?
I'm okay, Doug.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Just picking up some background. I wasn't sure if it was set to your headset or your other mic. Go ahead, Dave. You might want to repeat that last part.
I was just saying how can we expect to further anomalous research when Nobody wants to share. Nobody wants to publish their findings. Nobody wants to submit anything for peer review.
Well, we can't, and a lot of people talk about it, and there have been some people who have tried to get together with that, and I don't know, it's tough. From the examples I've seen where I think well-intentioned investigators are trying to pool or get people to share and pool for whatever reason, it's not easy to bring that together. It's not easy. It doesn't mean it can't be done. But I think it takes a strong attitude.
Right now, it's a mindset. Everybody wants to find this holy grail of the anomalous. You know, whether it's the picture of Elvis, or you know, something that can't be refuted. Well, unless we get together, it's not going to be considered credible. We have to get together, come to a common ground, and I think, do you see where I'm going?
Yeah, we need to share, and obviously that's one of the intentions behind Paranexus, is to share research, and that segues into the research projects that we are planning for this year, as you know, for membership to participate, and the encouraging of people to do such.
You know, it's one of those things where I personally feel that a lot of times people are so polarized, you know, that they feel that their data is conclusive, and yet they won't allow other folks to look at it, or they get all defensive when it's criticized or critiqued. And one of the things we've always talked about here is having a review. And, you know, submit your stuff. Don't be afraid. That's the only way. If you do have something significant, it's got to be reviewed by a bunch of other people, too. So, but I think some groups are very competitive. We've had people that have gotten very upset with us in the past, when in the Spirit team or in early in Paranexus, because of our stance on orbs. Very upset with us.
Yeah. And we all just blame Dave with it now. It used to be me, now we just shift the blame to Dave.
Hey, got to be good at something, right?
Yeah. So that's obviously something that we need to do, share, and we need to have the mindset to share.
And, I mean, you also have to take a look at, you know, okay, you've got, so you have an EVP, so you have, you know, a couple of irrefutable photographs. You have to sit down and ask yourself, in the grand scheme of things, so what? What does this mean to us? You know, what does this mean to the paranormal research community? What does this mean to humankind? You know, there can be, whether there is or is not anything paranormal, I mean, either way, it can have a huge impact on humanity, like we've discussed in the past. So, you know.
So that's the conventional is to basically try to come up with a holy grail oneself without.
Well, sure. Seems to be. I mean, you've got, look at your TV shows, for example. You've got numerous TV shows out there. They go out, they find all sorts of evidence that they're haunted tuberculosis clinics and cemeteries and whatnot. What happens to that evidence after the show is done? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
You know, nothing is followed up, to my knowledge.
Well,
saying this evidence was submitted to so-and-so for peer review, they just assume that their little board of experts there are, that's it. That's gossip. It's paranormal.
And on to the next.
Well, you know, I remember a certain group who shall remain nameless, who had infrared scanners and everything else. And I thought at times, you know, several years ago, that they got some stuff that was interesting on the infrared cameras. And, you know, whatever happened to that information?
Well, it's in their archives.
Yeah, and, I mean, it could be near development runs. I'm willing to make a fairly substantial bet that if you were to get a hold of these people and ask them to submit it for peer review, they'd go tell you to pound salt.
Probably.
But you know, an interesting difference between the haunting investigative community and the UFO investigative community in ufology, there are several databases. MUFON's got one, the International UFO Reporting Center's got one. There's others, and there have been a lot of sharing of cases and reports and things like that in that part of the field. Not so much in the the haunting parapsychology field.
Yeah, I think we have some lessons to learn from them. In the sense that, you know, they fought early too, I think, and eventually it came to the people who were serious about it, just like we're serious about it, finally formed groups like MUFON and you know, like we're forming Paranexus, or Paranexus formed to really, you know, take a step in a different direction and really try to get at what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So we've talked about the conventional thinking, a few points there. What about the non-conventional?
Non-conventional. Here's where I really get on my soapbox and turn things on its head. The way I see it and the way others see it, a few others see it right now, is paranormal investigations, specifically hauntings, have hit a brick wall. Okay? Again, it all boils back to, so what?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
What do the current techniques show us in the long run in relation to the human condition in the bigger picture? Absolutely nothing.
Well, we've learned what we've learned, and we can only speculate on a lot of it, but I agree. If you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. We need to do it differently.
I like that.
Old saying. Yeah, it's... You know, if nothing changes, nothing changes. That's another one. And I'm with you on that. So the non-conventional thinking then along these lines is what?
Well, we need to take a look at modern, current scientific theories. Okay, there's a number of current scientific theories out there, T-theory, M-theory, theories on multiverses, parallel dimensions, and whatnot. For those who might not be familiar with M theory, which is one of the more modern theories,
membrane.
Back in Einstein's day, he wanted to develop a theory of everything, and he proposed that there was up to 10 different parallel dimensions. We live in four. Three spatial, length, width, and depth, and one time. Some may argue that we only live in three, but
yeah,
time is a dimension on its own. Now, Einstein's theory of everything had 10 dimensions. Since then, there have been other theories, string theory, superstring theory, and most recently, M theory, which is an extension of string theory. That has 11 dimensions. Now, these dimensions can and have been known to interact. Particles have been proven to go from dimension to dimension. Now, with that said, and based on these different scientific theories that, you know, are accepted within the scientific community, we should be looking at correlating anomalous research with some of these scientific theories. Not necessarily the 100-year-old haunted house, But perhaps these EVPs or apparitions, anything, can be coming from not necessarily a haunted location, but from one of these parallel dimensions, one of these multiverses. I'm sure Dr. Roll will get into.
Yeah, and just a side note to that, in a couple of weeks, Dr. Roll will be on the program talking about entanglement in parapsychology, quantum entanglement. Go ahead.
That's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to that. But, a lot of people aren't going to like, you know, theories like this, because it totally takes everything that they believe and tosses it out the window, and it means learning a whole new path, potentially. Now, by conducting research outside the conventional places, you know, open fields, your own living room, dining room, whatever, much like Ingrid is doing, it may lead credence to these different scientific theories.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just because, like I said before, because a place isn't haunted doesn't mean that you can't conduct research.
Yeah, and we may also at some point down the line have more sophisticated means of technology where we may be able to detect it, you know, like, I mean, overlaps or phases in and outs or things like that. But
you have people that are conducting research into out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, even ufology. What's to say they're coming from another space or another, you know, another galaxy? Perhaps, you know, they might be coming from different reality or multiverse or parallel dimension, or I know. To some, it might sound kind of fringe, but I think it's something that, you know, maybe we should be looking a little bit in a little bit different direction. Because right now, we've got nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's no more fringe than much of what is currently believed in the haunting field and even in the UFO field was at the time it was put together. You know, I mean it. It grows. I mean, a lot of people, I'll probably offend somebody with this, but, you know, there was a time when I believed, you know, in the story of Adam and Eve. And now I just can't buy into that one anymore. So, but for four decades I did. And so people's belief, I mean, it gets, I don't know, you start believing things, you hear things, and then it becomes old hat. Well, we need to pick it up. We need to toss it around.
We need to step outside our comfort level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you're comfortable with one thing doesn't mean that it's the right thing or it's the right way of doing something. If it involves, you know, learning more about M-theory, more about multiverses, well, you know, it might not be your bag of tea, but...
But push yourself. Learn.
Yes,
it might very well be, but to switch things around and come up with some substantial evidence.
Well, I think you hit it right in the head, David. That's, you know, I mean, even your average person, guy on the street who knows nothing about paranormal, would feel just as probably uncomfortable with quantum physics, because quantum physics gets really weird and, you know, Einstein said it gets spooky. And, yeah, you know, when you start thinking about quantum entanglement and all these other kind of things, what it makes me wonder about is how much of this, what we think may be supernatural or a paranormal in nature, is not really paranormal at all, but maybe something that's intrinsic to humans. And we just don't know how to understand it and how it interacts with the environment that we're in. So, you know, you really have to think out of the box, and I think that the more innovative you are in how you approach it and how you and kick and brainstorm ideas, the better off you're going to be instead of running around a graveyard or running around a house that's 100 years old with a meter in your hand and a flashlight in the other.
Just take the multiverse theory, for instance. To a lot of people, that's going to sound very Stargate-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when you think about it, people have been studying this for hundreds of years. It's studied in space, or with astronomy, cosmology, physics, philosophy, psychology, and of course fiction, which blows it right out of proportion. But, you know, it's a whole theory of multiple universes and everybody's individual decisions, you know, multiple branches and whatnot.
Isn't it interesting to note that M theory, string theory, the multi-worlds concept, is an accepted avenue of study, of research in mainstream science?
However, paranormal investigation is not yet.
Yes. And it's almost a flip-flop, isn't it? It's like we're trying to tell the scientists, hey, there's something going on here that you need to study, and they say that's bunk. On the other hand, you know, there may be some paranormal investigators who say, what do you mean multiple universes? Come on. You know, it's flip-flop.
Well, that's why those few of us who are truly interested in investigating phenomena have to keep up the hard work. Because I think it's not going to be a case of ne'er the twain shall meet, but it's going to be the reverse. It's going to be they're going to meet. Mm-hmm. They're going to meet, because as we get more advanced in our research, and we get more sophisticated, what's going to happen is we may be able to say, to verify some of the same things that quantum science is. It's making leaps and bounds, and you can bet that once we get the Large Hadron Collider online and it's working, we're going to get some real interesting things, and we may get definitive proof.
Providing we don't all get sucked up in a black hole that they create.
Well, Dave, I can hardly sleep at night, you know. Ever since they fired it up, I've been terrified, you know.
Well,
canned goods and all the, you know, all the ammo I can for when the Hadron Collider starts up.
And they're looking for the God particle, right? What's the other name for that? Anybody remember? Can't remember it. Anyway, the God particle.
It's the Higgs boson.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, this is, you know, you're right. It's all coming together, and it should. And maybe that's the way that we will finally have some insight into what's going on with some of this anomalous stuff that we can't quite explain.
Yeah. And I mean, my whole way of thinking is, you know, a lot of people just pull comfort level. They got to get out of the comfort level. There's too many people inside the box. And we've got to get people thinking outside, thinking a little more freely.
Well, you know, you have to think outside of the box to be a paranormal investigator at first. But what really blows my mind about it is how some people will literally get stuck. And they get very afraid to progress beyond that point. Now, you have to be open-minded, even to accept the concept of spirits. And some folks can push it a step farther, you know, think of maybe extra dimensions or overlapping dimensions. They've seen a couple movies. I think, what was it, where they talked about that? I can't remember. The one with Tom Cruise's ex-wife, Nicole Kidman. What was that? The Outsiders or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I think that what troubled us, and we had a personal experience where we had a group of really solid people who we thought would make the transition from, you know, doing ghost investigations, hunting investigations, and they could not make the transition to a UFO investigation. They just couldn't wrap their mind around it, which to me, they're good people, you know, but they chose not to go there. They chose to shut it down and not open their mind mm-hmm. around a different type of investigation, and I think that runs true out there in the community.
Well, you know, we've talked about this a lot, and what we're really talking about here is what kind of meaningful evidence are we coming up with? I mean, at what point do we stop doing things, shall I say, in the traditional way in terms of investigations, and really start going to the investigation and look at it as a research project. You know, it's almost like a doctor treating the whole body, you know, the whole person rather than just one part. And so if we're looking for meaningful evidence, are we going to still do it the way we've done it? For example, are we going to be chasing lights in the sky and that's it to see some cool maneuvering? So what? Are we going to go in with, you know, the cameras rolling and you know, with the EMF meters on and yada, yada, just so we can maybe capture something that's anomalous? You know, again, so what?
Exactly. That's why I suggested, you know, conducting research outside the typical haunted location. As far as I'm concerned, you go into a location that's purported to be haunted, it's an uncontrollable environment. Okay, you've got people's belief systems, you've got your clients that are present, you've got their belief systems, they're going to be contaminating the scene, your other researchers are going to be contaminating the scene. If you conduct research on your own, you're able to control your environment. Should you get any sort of evidence, you should be able to reproduce that environment and try again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, scientific research is about controlled environments and reproduction.
If possible, yeah.
Possible.
Yeah, and so why not approach an investigation like a research project, going in to see what happened, you know, what's going on here, again, treating the whole thing rather than just the symptoms. You know, you get a client who says, you know, we've got some funky things happening around. Well, you go in and look at the entire picture, and I know you have part of this psychology things on your list, but we go in and we look, okay, what's going on in this home? What's the status of their relationships? You know, is there addiction, alcoholism, that kind of thing going on? Is there abuse of prescription drugs? Is there fighting? Is there a lot of stress in the family? Those things all have to be ruled out. You know, are there any disorders, for lack of a better term? You know, I mean, there could be some psychological issues going on. We have to rule all of that out before we even think about going looking at a paranormal conclusion.
Absolutely.
There's just a ton of factors involved, and you know, you just can never, and we keep emphasizing the importance of, you know, knowing where you are at, knowing what your belief system is before you even approach an investigation. But you know, if you're doing a haunting investigation, there's a couple of things you can do that are real research type of things that are very simple. You know, you could, if people are saying things are moving around a room, you can go into that room and you can set up a camera if you want, and you can set up little styrofoam things in specific places and see if they move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to be a PhD scientist to think of an experiment. Your room, and nobody's in the room, you know, you got the cameras rolling, and if something moves, well, that's some interesting data. Share it. Explain. And also, guys, and forgive me, Dave, but you also have to be able to document, okay? That's an important part. And if you don't write well, learn to write better. It's important to be able to communicate.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's all sorts of other things. Okay, things are moving around the room. Okay, well, get a hold of the local seismology department. Have there been any minor tremors? Earth plates are constantly shifting. You know, no, as far as I'm concerned, no place is earthquake proof.
Could be underground water. You don't know what it could be.
Minor tremors everywhere. Is the location on a major trucking route? You know, it could be as simple as that. You get a couple tractor trailers, fully loaded tractor trailers driving by.
You know, Dave, when you say that, I'm always reminded of a case years ago, and I'm sure people in our audience are familiar with it. It was about a lady who was having all kinds of problems, feeling she's being watched, anxious, heart palpitations. And, you know, when the researchers came out to visit her, because she was at her wit's end, think that she was haunted, well, when they got close to her house, they saw that her house was close to a huge power line, yep. right underneath one of the power grids. And as a result, she was being bombarded, her and her family, and the animals and everybody else in the house, with huge amounts of electrostatic radiation that was coming from those as a byproduct. And we all know what that can do to people.
One case that we had, individual was waking up with stuffed animals in her bed. Turns out that she sleptwalked.
Oh, really?
Yeah. While she was sleeping, and she was getting up and picking up these animals, bringing them to bed.
Yeah, well, that's an Occam's razor
mm-hmm.
right there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why not approach investigations, whether they're parapsychological or UFO hauntings, UFO events, abduction events, why not approach them with an experiment or a research project in mind? You know, that's a different way of thinking, too. And we're getting a little bit low on time, so let's hit the other things you've got on your list, too, Dave.
I think the last couple both have the same topic, and they all fall under psychology. And we were talking about it briefly there before, but when you look at a lot of these hauntings and even UFO abduction experiences and possessions, you have to look at the psychology behind them before you actually look at the case. You know, possessions in particular. You got all these people, they're all getting possessed by every demon there is in any religion, and you know, now they're conducting exorcisms on Skype, which was, that's another show completely right there.
Yeah.
The psychology behind it.
I think we should get that. We should corner the market on that.
Yeah, really. Turn
Exorcist Universe and exorcisms on air.
That's right. Live exorcism every week.
Like I mentioned earlier, right? Exorcism
by proxy,
brought to you by the makers of Devil Be Gone, Antiperspirant.
Yeah. Yeah. And
what's the psychology behind these possessions? You know, just about every case in history, it didn't come down to an actual possession. It was all psychological disorders until a religious faith got involved and planted the seed of possession. It was automatically deemed, you know, the psychologist, psychiatrist said, you know, it could be schizophrenia, it could be a bunch of things. Religious person steps in, automatically, possession. Okay, then the person starts speaking in tongues. Then the large-scale PK activity starts being directed towards that person.
Yep.
And before, any PK activity was, you know, wasn't directed at the person. It was just, you know, a book falling off the shelf.
Wouldn't it be funny if all those people that were attempting to exorcise or that person's demon were inadvertently contributing to their misery, to their own, you know, the discharge of psychokinetic energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If they were heightening that whole experience and embellishing and magnifying it.
Yeah, the brain is such a powerful experience. I mean, you plant that seed, this person is possessed by the devil or a demon or, you know, insert name here, they're going to start a whole series of self-doubt. Oh my God, I'm bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in hell. You know, God hates me. I've got this demon inside me, and it just starts a slippery slope that just goes right downhill.
And so then the exorcist comes in and does their thing, which often does seem to resolve the issue. So couldn't it be said that an exorcism is merely the act of persuading the person to believe something different?
Or maybe it's reinforcing the belief system that they already have, because they had to believe they had a demon to begin with.
That's the danger right there.
And then, so in order, the only thing that can possibly save them from the onset, according to the constructs of their belief system, is a holy man So what the heck's the difference between whether you have a priest or whether you have a shaman?
Mm-hmm.
None. So for all of our highfalutin talk about how advanced we are in 21st century, well, folks, look around, man. We got lots of shamans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just an FYI for our listeners, if you want to read a case in point about an exorcism, is a quote-unquote exorcism that happened by one of our field investigators, Gaurav Tiwari in India. He posted that in his blog on paranexus.org. Go ahead, Dave.
That was an excellent blog.
Oh, it was brilliant. I mean, he handled it brilliantly. It was perfect. It was absolutely, he nailed it.
And, you know, there also, we've been kicking it around, too. There's that other paper that's out, and I apologize to the gentleman who wrote it. I believe his last name is Kundun. And he did a really nice paper on what the belief systems, basically, wasn't labeled as such, but the state of paranormal research, and it's very similar to what we've been talking about, and the implications of what bad researchers do and how it impacts the field. So I'm sure what we can do is we can post that on Paranexus if we already haven't done that. And I would strongly encourage our audience to take a peek at that because that's very interesting as well.
It's posted. I'm not sure if it's in
the Yeah, I thought, yeah.
Not, but yeah.
Yeah, it may have been all for members because that was like a mandatory read. It was really very well done and very thoughtful and very, you know, and the gentleman who wrote it was very sincere about his desire to, you know, do serious research.
Well, you know, so there's a lot of, I guess we need to start wrapping things up. So we've talked about some conventional approaches and maybe what we need to do differently, we've highlighted some non-conventional approaches that we also need to take in mind. Any summations, Dave, or thoughts?
Like I kept stating and will continue to state, you know, step outside the box. It's getting inside your comfort level, you know, so be it. We've got to shake things up if we're going to come up with any definitive solid proof.
Yes, so to kind of reiterate what we've talked about, you know, there's nothing necessarily unique about any particular location. We can try research projects in any location, and we should, to compare, for one thing. We talked about cemeteries that just, you know, beyond perhaps a training ground, you know, is it really reasonable to expect them to be haunted? We talked about us, me, and we, and the need to share data. We talked about how investigations, research into the paranormal, into the anomalous fields across the board have pretty much hit a brick wall. We need to start thinking outside the box. We talked about some of the scientific theories, M theory, the multi-worlds theory, parallel dimensions, and so on, and got into this a little bit of the psychology of things. So my advice is keep thinking outside the box. Come up with research projects rather than just go on investigations. What kind of projects can we do? That will add, especially during downtime. I mean, how many teams have those slow periods? What kind of research projects can you construct? For example, where are EVPs coming from? I know Ingrid's going to construct a Faraday cage. Can somebody else do that too? And put a recorder inside of it? Can you create a soundproof box and put a recorder inside of it to, you know, test it, to make sure it works fine so that the other voices can't be overheard? Those are just a couple of quick examples off the top of my head.
Yeah, just think differently when you approach it. Instead of going out with five people, go out with three people or go out with two people. Do a quiet investigation as opposed to a loud one. And just document. Do three different people document their impressions. And then cross-reference your impressions. It can be a good start. Encourage everybody in your team to document.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
And next week, I don't have a theme for you, but we will post on Paranexus. We appreciate our listeners. Thanks for stopping in. Those who are listening to the archive, we appreciate you listening, too. Please visit paranexus.org. Join us. We'd love to have you as a member and join us in this quest for answers. So have a great night and a great week. Good night.
Yeah. Good night, everybody.